We're going to get underway with our first plenary. Now, this is a really interesting one. This topic is social risks and social capital, tales from the world's first social risk officer. And this actually grows out of a piece of work, although this sounds like it's very topical and it might have been put together in response to the Royal Commission. This is actually a piece of work that's been going for much longer. Ian's been thinking on this and doing research on this and actually released a paper a little while ago that some of you might have seen. And then he's since then joined up with Hayden and they've progressed the work in a slightly different direction. So very interesting topic at the moment. Financial institutions have been regularly subjected to public opprobrium in the press, in politics, on social media for attitudes and behaviour which the community finds unacceptable. One emerging area of practice has something to offer: social capital management. So we're going to hear from Ian Lachlan and Hayden Bernot. Ian has a deep interest in risk management and risk culture, particularly in the financial services world. He has had a long career in financial services senior management and board roles in various countries. He chairs the boards of a group of insurance companies owned by one of the major banks. He's also an advisory board chairman of Blackhall and Pearl, a specialist risk management and board performance firm. Until mid-2015, he was deputy chairman of APRA, the prudential regulator of banks, insurance companies and super funds. Hayden Bernot is the managing director of Causeway, a new actuarial and strategy consultancy looking to reshape corporate and NFP decision making by blending actuarial and relational thinking. For example, how can better pricing decisions be made by incorporating their impact on customer relationship capital? Please welcome Ian and Hayden.
Thanks, Melinda. We're going to tell you a story and we hope you enjoy it. It's 2012. The global financial sector is recovering from the GFC, but there's still a lot of flux and uncertainty. George is the CRO of General Banking Corporation, GBC, a very large Australian financial services conglomerate. GBC's got a new CEO, a woman, Jane. And Jane comes from a background in business consulting, where she had many financial services clients, and mining. She also sits on the board of a major social institution which is involved in mental wellness. Jane is expected to take a very different, non-traditional approach to the business. Indeed, this is one reason the board chose her as CEO. It wanted fundamental change. Soon after starting, Jane calls George, the CRO, in for a chat. Now, he's a bit apprehensive, not knowing what to expect and not even sure that he's going to keep his job. She says she has long been a student of financial services, its history, its culture and practices. She says she doesn't like the trajectory of the industry. She worries that it has become arrogant, that it's not paid enough attention to the lessons of the GFC, that its remuneration provides the wrong incentives and its culture is inappropriate. She says that she's seen firsthand the damage to the mining industry of poor relations with communities. In her consulting work, she's had to help financial services companies deal with a range of behavioural issues, and that bothers her. With her work in mental health, she's seen some of the consequences of the industry's attitudes and behaviour. She says that the industry may not be alert to the views of society. What views, thinks George. George is taken aback. This wasn't what he was expecting. Why was she raising this with him, the CRO? Jane goes on. Imagine if it got so bad that there was political upheaval and some sort of public inquiry where the industry had its dirty laundry hung up for everyone to see. She mentions social licence, a phrase new to George, and he wonders what it means. And why on earth a public inquiry? Then it becomes a little clearer. She challenges George to consider the risks that might lead to such a situation. Okay, he muses, even if her thinking is a bit strange, he can see why she's speaking to him about her ideas. The risks she's referring to may be real. George is conscious that he needs to keep an open mind, and Jane asks him to think deeply about what she has said and to come back in 3 weeks with some thoughts. George mulls over the conversation over coming days. He's very alert to the idea that she's been thinking about these ideas for some time and may be well ahead of him in her thought processes. He thinks she's given him a hint, though. Think about the risks behind her concerns. George reviews the risk register that doesn't think it gives him any insights at all. And the risk appetite statement sheds no insights either. He spends a lot of time thinking critically about attitudes in the industry and how they might be seen in wider society. He reviews reports from customer complaint services. He spends a lot of time reading comments on social media. He speaks to his family and friends about what they think, and he's shaken by what he finds. He starts to form a view that society and the industry may be a little out of sync. George's skills as a CRO enable him to look at this through a risk lens. He concludes that there are numerous risks, big risks, that are not being addressed, what he now decides to call social risks. As his thoughts start to gel, he thinks he needs to use his emerging thinking to challenge the C-suite about these risks and see how they respond. Do you think we accept some... This is what the conversation is that he had. Do you think we accept some poor behaviour and attitudes from our staff when we think it will help our results? Are we a little cynical in our approach? Well, there'll always be some poor behaviour. It's, you know, part of the price of doing business. We work in the real world. Do you think we patronise our customers a little because we think we know what is best for them? Absolutely. There are many misinformed views out there. Financial services is complex. It's up to us. We need to hold them by the hand. Do you think we might be condoning poor behaviour without realising that is how it's seen by others? Not really. We've got a pretty good handle on what's reasonable. Our compliance and whistleblower systems will pick up any issues. Do you think our espoused values are consistent with society's expectations? Of course, who could argue with them? There they are, up on the wall. Do you think our true underlying values, the way it actually is in the business, are consistent with the espoused values? Well, the list up on the wall is aspirational, of course. The values are meant to motivate. We employ many different people, and of course they don't all have the same values. And do you think we have a good handle on society's norms and expectations and how they're changing? What insight do we have into the way society thinks? Well, I'm not sure what you mean, and really, why are you asking me this? Do you think society's tolerance for our practices is changing? Society doesn't tell us what's reasonable, but they wouldn't really know. Do you think we understand and respond to the differing social attitudes of different generations? Of course, I've got parents and I've got children. Do you think disgruntled customers are getting more power to damage us through social media and so on, and are more willing to have a go? Well, consumer regulation is getting tougher, no doubt. Do you think we're becoming more exposed to litigation about our behaviour? Well, there are too many lawyers in this country. Do you think politicians are willing and able to cynically exploit any negative views society may have of us? Well, we spend a lot of time and money on our relations with politicians. We know them pretty well, and we stay very close to them. And do you think the media is willing to take only partially true accusations against us and blow them up into a major story? We've got a media relations department that's focused on providing the true picture and our side of the story. And do you think our accurate version of events could be dismissed in the media as fake news? What on earth is fake news? And do you think society could be swayed by blatant lying by politicians promoted as if true? Well, politicians always lie in a subtle way because they would not get away with outright mistruths, and the internet will keep them honest enough. Now, George is dismayed by the responses, at how narrow the thinking is amongst his colleagues, at how sure of themselves they are. They appear to think that society will accept what the industry thinks is best. They consistently look through the eyes of the shareholder and at what might be in their own best interests as employees earning bonuses. Value statements and customer-focused mantras are seen as window dressing. They're completely blind to his social risks. He asks himself what could be done about these social risks. He concludes that they need to be managed just like any other risk, but social risks aren't even on their risk register. He spends a lot of time thinking about possible indicators of these social risks. He's acutely conscious that GBC's current risk indicators tend to be backward-looking. In that sense, are not so much indicators as measures of outcomes. He realises that the inherent value of managing social risks will be lost if there's not a forward-looking perspective taken. To do this, he realises he needs a way to sense the underlying causes of social risks. And to do that, he thinks he needs sensors that will tell him in almost real time what's happening in society. He's been reading about the new technology coming in self-driving cars and how they have a range of sensors, radar and so on, that look forward, and that gives him some ideas. He starts work on what sensors for social risks might be. So he engages a social media expert, an organisational psychologist, a clinical psychologist, and an expert in the emerging field of artificial intelligence. And from this comes proposals for ways to develop a deep understanding of contemporary social norms and attitudes and the way they're changing. This gives him an idea of the likelihood of these social risks eventuating. George meets again with Jane after 3 weeks and he talks her through what he's done and what he's concluded. He then offers his resignation as CRO. Jane looks at him unfazed and she says, "I want you to appoint me as the GBC Social Risk Officer. I want you to give me the opportunity to make a truly significant difference." She smiles and shakes his hand. "I love what you're doing and how you're thinking," she says. "But one more thing, how on earth are we going to measure the potential impact of these social risks, as you call them?"
How to measure the impact of social risks? Well, 10 seconds into his new role, this is not how George had pictured the conversation going. He was kind of hoping Jane might say something about a pay rise, or maybe about the vacant corner office on the top floor, but her question focuses his mind. He thinks, "Okay, let me start in familiar territory, financial risks. A financial risk event destroys financial capital, so maybe social risks destroy social capital. If so, then my job as social risk officer would revolve around this so-called social capital, managing it, protecting it, and understanding it. Where should I start? What about this? How big is it? How big is GBC's social capital?" Well, if social capital isn't intangible, let's find out how big intangibles are in total. He finds this data for the top 500 listed companies in the US. Intangibles have been increasing dramatically over time, and recently we're sitting at 80% of company value. George's research takes him to South Africa next, where all listed companies are now required to report on their tangible and intangible capitals. It's called integrated reporting, and apparently it's gaining traction in the UK and Japan as well. Two of the six capitals that they report on are tangible, financial and manufactured capital. Four are intangible, one of which is called social and relational capital. So George pulls a team of GBC execs together to have a go at roughly sizing their social capital. GBC's market cap is $100 billion, with $40 billion of tangible capital, leaving $60 billion in intangibles. Working through scenarios, they decide that social capital is doubly as influential on GBC's outcomes as is human and intellectual capital. So they size GBC's social capital in 60 minutes at $40 billion. George starts to sweat. He wonders what possessed him to volunteer to manage a $40 billion asset which he knows nothing about. But George is tough. He keeps going. Next step, monitoring and indicators. At GBC, the key indicators relevant to social capital seem to be customer NPS, employee engagement, and brand research. George studies recent social risk events and notices a disturbing theme across many industries, and he starts to sweat more. In every case, just before the catastrophic event, these exact three social indicators were showing up as green. Not red, not amber, green. Of course, after the event, the indicators went straight to red. He realises all our indicators must be backward-looking, lagging indicators. We need something new. And his mind goes back to childhood on his parents' apple orchard. His dad always taught him not to be distracted by the P&L outcomes, like the size of the crop last season. To understand the true state of the apple orchard balance sheet asset, his dad would measure the health of the trees, the health of the soil, and the state of their irrigation systems. He shares these thoughts with Jane, and she answers him with a story, a mining story from Papua New Guinea. It's a long story, but her key point is that social capital is built and lost based on the strength of the stakeholder relationships. So George searches the globe looking for a tool that measures relationships in a balance sheet and leading indicator kind of way. And he finds one with some promise in the UK called relational analytics. Just like his dad measuring the state of the trees, soil and irrigation, relational analytics measures the state of five underlying relational conditions. Power. Is there mutual respect in the relationship? Is power used in a fair way? And can both parties truly influence and participate in the relationship? Is there a sense of parity? Information. How well do the two parties really know and understand each other and their motivations? Do they know why the other party behaves the way they do? Communication. This is about both quantity and quality. How much is face-to-face? Is it honest and transparent? Purpose. How aligned are the two parties? Would they say they have a common purpose? What about common values? And how well are any differences managed? Story. How much backstory do the two parties have together? And is it memorable and meaningful? How solid is their planned future? Is there a sense of momentum? Relational analytics says that where these five elements are strong, you have high relational proximity and high trust and commitment and empathy. So this relational work reminds George that on the other side of GBC's social capital are the people of Australia who are providing their personal social capital, which becomes a liability on the GBC balance sheet. The asset it creates for GBC, he names social goodwill. So George uses relational analytics to profile GBC's social goodwill and dig deeper. He's looking particularly for weak spots which would indicate social risks. Unsurprisingly, the worst relationship was with ex-customers. Blue means healthy, red means unhealthy. But he and his exec team were surprised to see such unhealthy relational conditions with their wealth customers and with the general public. Looking vertically down the table, they saw that communication and power were two clear risk areas for GBC. But George is most disturbed by just the sheer quantity of red on the page. He asks the relational analytics practitioners, "Is that normal?" And they shake their heads. The next thing George wants to know is how significant is each stakeholder group? How much does each one contribute to GBC's social goodwill? And so George births a new concept, the social goodwill unit. One SGU is the value of a relationship between GBC and an individual where that relationship is in perfect health and the relational proximity is one. A relationship in very bad health would be worth negative one SGUs. So in aggregate, the total SGUs is the number of people times the average quality of the relationships. And the outcome of his first go at this calculation, 10.5 million relationships running at positive 19% relational proximity, giving 2 million SGUs. And here's how he broke it down. For customers, the number of people impacted is easy. It's just the number of customers. It's a direct relationship. For the general public, it's the small proportion of the Australian public who genuinely listen to and engage with GBC's marketing efforts. The relationship with staff impacts large numbers of people indirectly because staff in turn interact with customers. A healthy staff relationship produces more social goodwill between GBC and its customers, and ditto with media and government. George sees that the biggest source of social goodwill is via staff, followed by retail customers. And there's large social badwill and therefore large social risk with the media. He feels he's hit on something here, that he now has a way to measure social capital in a forward-looking way and pick up social risks early. So fast forward a few years to the end result of George's work with Jane's ongoing support. In the wealth business, that power imbalance between the bank and the customers was analysed in depth, and structural changes were made to advisor remuneration and to increase the agency of customers in decision making. For ex-customers, Jane created a specialist off-boarding team of 20 staff. Some are in the call centre ensuring that customers leave well. She recruited some from iSelect to help customers choose the best new bank and product for them. Some meticulously gathered exit feedback and published it on the GBC website along with a management response to each one. The remainder worked on dozens of new innovations based on the exit feedback. Media. Jane personally formed a relationship with the one media outlet with the most social bad will and appeared on their show once a week. And she created a team of five who were on call to answer any and all media questions on GBC or banking in general, as well as co-designing a new monthly reporting pack on the bank's operations prepared just for that media outlet. George became a secret weapon in GBC's merger and acquisition activity. He was brought in to estimate a potential acquisition's social balance sheet. He discovered they had huge stores of social goodwill with government and media, which the other buyers paid little attention to. They bought the business, and this social goodwill ended up generating massive returns for GBC with flow-on effects in their core business. George produced a yearly social condition report, which became the board's favourite report each year. And Jane named George Employee of the Month, a record 12 months in a row. George stopped sweating and started smiling again. The end.
I love it. Social condition report, probably a better read than the financial condition report, maybe, for the board. Okay. Would anyone like to kick us off with the first question? I'm just waiting for questions to come through from your SMSs. So I might start the first one. I love this concept. How did George go about, or what tips can you give us on how George goes about measuring the strength of those relationships with customers? Because, you know, we've got a series of imperfect tools at the moment. We've got net promoter scores, and then we've got, you know, other measures. So depending what measure you can use for the same group of customers, you can get a positive or a negative. So, you know, what tips can you give us on how to actually go about doing this?
So current measures tend to be transactionally focused and, yeah, and usually backward-looking, because they usually gather just after an interaction. So they're backward-looking. So we need
something. And so they are only really measuring a small part of the relationship as well, just around what they've just done.
That's right. And yeah, it's usually in the context of how well are we serving you. But
so it's like the customer could hate us, but they found that call centre person quite efficient, so they give you 8 out of 10.
That's right. So yeah, how do we get to the underlying foundations of the relationship, I guess, is where we need to go.
And that's measuring the soil and the environmental health as a sort of proxy to that.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess the thing I'd find hardest in doing that, though, is getting those, you know, the 10.5 million customers and giving them the actual score piece. That's the challenge piece. Okay,
I think one way of doing that, Melinda, would be, if you take the population at large, would be to survey them, not on a simple thing like NPS, but in a much more comprehensive way.
Yeah.
So you, on the basis of a sample, you would get a feel for the strength of the relationship using those various different factors that Hayden went through in his presentation.
I have a question here about the relationship scores in the UK that you mentioned, and the question's how long have they been used?
Yeah, about 25 years. So there's a body called Relational Research, previously Relationships Foundation, that have used these relational scores in lots of contexts over those 25 years, from business, not-for-profit, government, schools, prisons, and even international peacemaking. So there's quite a body of research and data that's been, and experience that's been built up. And it's being used quite a lot in South Africa to help the listed companies measure their social and relational capital as part of the integrated reporting.
Another question. These are very practical questions. People are obviously thinking about how they do this in their businesses. How can you measure the number of people affected through media? Because that could be huge.
I don't know is the answer to that. That's a tricky one, and that's the cutting edge of practice that I haven't seen anyone do yet.
So I would answer that by saying, if it was newspaper X, you would survey readers of newspaper X, and you'd get a feel, therefore, for their scores.
Is anyone actually doing this in Australia yet, Hayden? Maybe you can help us with your consulting services actually implement that. Do you know of anyone who's actually... I know this is very new work.
Yes. From what I understand, it's only been used once or twice so far in Australia, but lots overseas.
How many of Jane's executive team thought the social capital concept was just new mumbo-jumbo? Great question. I guess you spoke to that, Ian, didn't you? The kind of...
It's very easy to dismiss, especially in an audience like this, you know, when we're looking at hard numbers and analysis and so on. It's easy to dismiss this as not very important. Our argument is that it's actually a lot more important than a lot of the numbers. It's just not well understood. You need to think in terms of the risks that are actually not being managed. And it's easy to argue that the situation that we're in at the moment, that is, you know, the financial services world being under the microscope, is really indicative of a fundamental failure of risk management. How else could we be in this position if we have not failed in risk management? And when you start from that point, then a lot of this makes a lot more sense.
And I think for the GBC exec team, they really stood up and took notice when they saw that this social capital could be worth $40 billion, as much as their financial capital. And they thought about how much expertise, effort, investment they put into managing their financial capital and how well they understand how it moves, and realised that they needed to lift their game on this other equally large asset.
A last question, I think. This is an interesting one. So treating a small number of customers very badly may have low social capital. So is that okay? So how would your model cope with that? Or does the media risk then weigh up for those customers?
No,
give it a higher score?
It's a great question, because usually it's a very small number of the most disenfranchised, marginalised customers or stakeholders that cause all the social risk problems. And so one way you can apply this methodology is to focus in on the bottom 1 or 2% of relationships and measure those, and how much social bad will is coming out of those. And that's a great idea to do.
Look, fascinating. I think we could probably have at least another half an hour of Q&A on this. It's a fascinating topic. You are putting out some information, more information on this. You're writing a paper.
I will, sure.
Yes. Well, I know Ian's written the first paper, and I know you guys are doing more work, so it was a question. Are you intending to?
We're interested, and
we're keen to hear more, I think, is what you're hearing from the volume of questions here. So please join me in thanking Hayden and Ian.